Self-driving cars are coming to our streets, but are self-driving tanks coming to battlefields? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with a former Army Ranger, military analyst, and author about the prospects of robot-based warfare. And that conversation begins now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. Of course, artificial intelligence is like any new technology. It can be used for good or for bad. Early tests show that AI, artificial intelligence, can notice and diagnose certain types of cancer with just retinal scans. So what if AI can put the capabilities of a driverless car into a predator drone?
It's going to enable the ability to build autonomous weapons that could go out and hunt for targets on their own and attack them without any other human input or involvement.
This is no longer the territory of science fiction like Blade Runner or with Skynet from RoboCop. No nation has said they will build autonomous weaponry for its military. Global spending, though, on military robotics is estimated to reach $7.5 billion this year. This week, our guest is a former U.S. Army Ranger, a military analyst with a Pentagon post, and an author. He traces the emergence of this technology, drawing on his personal experiences through four combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, to explore the moral and practical challenges of machine decision-making in today's modern war. Here we go.
Paul Shari, I'm the Senior Fellow and Director for the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security.
I was reading this morning, as we tape, it's Google I.O. It's about to wrap up, the Google Developer Conference. And this morning, the AI chief at Google, Jeff Dean, the new AI chief, made a point to say that Google should not be involved in autonomous weaponry. We're going to get into your book, Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. But real quick, is that really a concern that needs to be stated specifically at an I.O. developer conference?
It doesn't normally seem like it should be. Now, in this case, there was this brouhaha several weeks ago where it had come to light that Google was working with the Defense Department on using AI-based tools to do object identification in drone feeds. And that prompted this letter signed by over 3,000 Google employees objecting to this. So I think it's a place now where the Google leadership does have to weigh in. They have to say, where are we drawing the line? Mm. And that's, I think it's a very reasonable place to draw the line, to say that there are some, you know, applications of Google's tools and software for the Defense Department that might be totally unobjectionable. And then there are others, and, you know, drawing the line at weapons seems like a great place to do it, to say Google's not going to move into that. Google's not going to be building weapons.
But I read the book, most of it, and no nation state has said they're going to build autonomous weapons, but they haven't ruled it out either, right?
That's right. So we're in this interesting place where the technology is racing forward, and it's going to enable the ability to build autonomous weapons that could go out and hunt for targets on their own and attack them without any other human input or involvement. Now, countries, no one has said, you know, we are definitely going to build autonomous weapons. But as you said, very few countries have said they're not going to do it. No leading military power or robotics developer has ruled it out.
Right.
And when you look at what they're building, these technologies will come right up to the line. And so it's not clear whether they're planning to cross it, or in some cases, I think at least for the U.S. government, I actually think they haven't made that decision yet.
Okay. You are incredibly plugged in. I was watching your Carnegie Academy speech, and you have a lot of still images of weaponry. Any of those top secret? I mean, did you have to?
Not the ones on the web. No.
Okay, because I was like, wow, he's really getting in there and showing me exactly what these things do. Let's get to your creation story, and then we'll get into the weeds, okay?
Yeah.
How did you come about to write the book?
Sure. So I served in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. I did four tours. I was an Army Ranger. I was a sniper, led a reconnaissance team. So I spent a lot of time downrange in these conflicts. And afterwards, after I got out, I worked in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as a civilian policy analyst. And one of the things that I worked on was emerging technologies, autonomy, drones, directed energy technologies. And I was in a role where I was working on investments, but also policies. And this was something that kept coming up, was as we were building more advanced robotic systems, people inside the military were actually asking, what's our policy on this? We could see a path towards greater autonomy, but there was sort of somewhere down the line going to be this critical question of, well, how much control are we going to give to these machines? they have guns on them already. Are we going to be willing to delegate, say, targeting decisions to these machines?
Uh-huh.
I worked on that when I was in the Pentagon. I led the working group inside the Defense Department that drafted the official policy directive that was published in 2012 and is still in place. It's up on the web if you want to take a look at it. And then, since leaving the Pentagon, working at the Center for New American Security, I've been working on this issue for a number of years, engaged in international discussions at the UN, talking to engineers, talking to policymakers to try to better understand this problem. So eventually, you know, the issue kind of got to the point, and my thoughts kind of got to the point where I said, I really want to write a book on this and help bring this to a wider audience. And that's really what the book is aimed for, is not just engineers, not just people working in the military space, but everyone who might be interested in where the future of warfare and the role of humans and autonomy is going.
Let's go back to one of several foundational documents that you had that you built off of. I want to ask you about the Air Force flight plan from 2009. What was in that?
Yeah, so this was really, I think, a key milestone within the Defense Department. In the late sort of aught years, 2007, 2008, 2009, the military sort of woke up to what I would call an accidental robotics revolution. They had deployed thousands of air and ground robots into Iraq and Afghanistan to meet urgent needs for bomb disposal, for overhead surveillance with drones. It wasn't really part of the military's plan at the time to build thousands of robots, but they needed them and they rushed them to theater. And then afterwards, the military services were kind of grappling, well, what does all of this mean? And they started writing these roadmaps or plans going towards the future. The Air Force referred to theirs at the time as a flight plan, looking out 30 years into the future for where the technology was going for future next generation drones. And something that kept coming up was more autonomy. We want more autonomy. Because anybody who's worked with any kind of teleoperated robotic system knows it's just really cumbersome. It's a very fragile way to operate robotic systems. Same thing in the military environment, almost more so there because communications can be so unreliable. So that 2009 flight plan that the Air Force put out for what they prefer to call unmanned aircraft systems, UASs, they don't like the term drones, that flight plan really sort of pointed to this future of increased autonomy in combat roles. Now, one of the things the Air Force talks about is what they refer to as an OODA loop, an observe, orient, decide, act loop, similar to what you might think of as a sense, decide, act loop in robotics. This idea that the paradigm is that in combat operations, the person who wins is the one who can understand the environment, make a decision, and act quicker than the enemy. And completing this cognitive process is most important. It's more important than the weapons you have or the vehicle you're in. It's being able to understand and make a decision and act faster. And obviously, automation has huge advantages here. So the Air Force talked about in this document, well, what if we took the human out completely and we entirely automated this decision cycle? And they didn't say they wanted to do it. What they did say is we could see the military advantages in speed, and this is going to raise really tricky legal and ethical and policy questions. And they basically said, we need to have these conversations now. And that document actually spurred, 3 years later, the Defense Department policy on autonomy and weapons.
Okay. Is it sensational for me to ask if this is an arms race already?
No, I think it's a question that's on many people's minds. It's one that I grapple with in the book. I would hesitate to say that we are in an arms race already because I don't see any countries clearly saying, you know, we're going to build autonomous weapons. I would say that we're at the starting blocks of an arms race. That's a potential risk. You see a number of actors, non-governmental organizations, human rights organizations, some international organizations like the ICRC saying, well, look, we want to avert an arms race. We don't want to do that. You see several open letters that have been signed by scientists and engineers. Stuart Russell at Berkeley has been standing up and talking about this quite a bit, saying we need to avert an arms race. And I don't think we're there yet, but it's definitely a real risk.
Didn't you write for Defense One sometime in November that there was a meeting, that we're running out of time, that we need to have a summit and set some guardrails around this? What happened at that meeting in November 2017?
Yeah, so we have had 5 years now worth of diplomatic discussions at the United Nations. There was one in November of last year. There was the most recent one in April of this year. What happened? Well, you know, not very much at all of these discussions. It's diplomacy. It moves very, very slowly.
Yes.
And so it's been a very slow process diplomatically. And one of, I think, the concerns of many involved in this is the real asymmetry in the pace of developments here, where you have diplomats meeting 1 week per year to try to wrap their minds around this. Very slow progress. Meanwhile, the technology is moving forward at a breakneck pace.
Great segue. I wanted to spend the rest of our time talking about the technology, okay? Let's use a couple of examples, a couple that stood out to me. The first one was the Chinese example of a stolen submersible that belonged to the United States. Can you tell us about that story and what may have happened while it was in China's hands?
Well, so about a year and a half ago, there was an incident where China grabbed a hold of an underwater drone that the U.S. had operating in the South China Sea. They just, there's nobody there. It's a robotic vehicle, so they just took it.
It can't defend itself.
I think it's a significant challenge for future more expensive robotics or ones that might have more sensitive equipment. The Navy is putting out to sea an entirely robotic ship called the Sea Hunter. And it's designed to track enemy submarines. It's going to have very sensitive military equipment on board. Mm. And this raises the question of, you know, if someone were to try to grab a hold of it, what do you want it to do? Would you allow it to use force to defend itself? Maybe with non-lethal weapons, maybe you put water cannons on it. Maybe with lethal weapons, maybe you put guns on it. That's a really tricky question to try to grapple with.
Right. And I pulled you off the China story. I'm sorry about that. But I just was...
Well, in this case, what happened was the U.S. protested, say, hey, you know, give us our drone back. The Chinese government said, oh, we're so sorry. We didn't mean to. That was totally unauthorized. Just some low-level person doing that. Gave it back after a couple days. It seems reasonable to think that their engineers did a little bit of poking around in the technology first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a major concern with these systems is that, you know, somebody else could grab a hold of them and then get a hold of this very sensitive military technology. Obviously, the Chinese are very good at stealing IP and reverse engineering things.
You'd make a distinction that I'd like you to parse for me, which is the technology behind targeting versus technology for navigation and how it applies to full autonomy.
I don't think that it makes sense to talk about a, quote, autonomous system in the abstract. I think it's most valuable to talk about autonomous in what respect. And I'll give an example for cars today. Cars have a lot of autonomy in them in various features. You buy a top-of-the-line automobile, you've got features like self-parking, intelligent cruise control, automatic braking, automatic lane keeping. These are all various kinds of automated or autonomous features, but in very narrow respects. So in the military sense, similarly, if we say, well, this military robot or this drone, even if it has a weapon on it, it has autonomy. Well, what feature is autonomous? What is it doing autonomously? Is it driving on its own? Is it shooting weapons on its own? Huge difference between those. And we have seen robotic vehicles already deployed that have some measure of autonomy. Israel has deployed a robotic vehicle on the Gaza border called the Guardian that they have said is doing a lot of driving on its own autonomously, but there's a machine gun on it and a human is still controlling the targeting decisions.
Mm.
And so I think you really want to parse that out. I'll point an example to say a self-driving car. Even in that case, if you get into a, quote, fully autonomous car, maybe you get into a Google car, there's no steering wheel, it drives all on its own, the human is still choosing the destination. But the human is still saying where you want to go. And so we want to think about what's this balance of human and machine decision making and what decisions are still reserved for humans.
Another great segue, because I was thinking about machines making machines, right? We're getting to the point where deep learning and other legs on the stool for artificial intelligence are going to be able to respond in kind. The skill set will be a domino thing, right? You ask a robot to pick up a rock, it's going to learn how a hand works. And then when a hand breaks, it's going to learn how to fix it. Does that kind of thinking step into this? Is this a major challenge for autonomous weaponry?
I think it absolutely is. And in part because we've seen these amazing gains in machine learning in the past couple of years, in particular through things like deep reinforcement learning, generative adversarial networks, or self-play in things like AlphaGo and other games. And these are very, very powerful tools to build machines to solve tasks. But these machines also have a lot of vulnerabilities. They have trouble adapting to novelty, to new environments. They can learn the wrong things. They can fall victim to safety and control problems like reward hacking. It's one thing when you have this in a setting of, say, playing a computer game, and then maybe the bot does something clever. One of my favorite examples was a bot learning to play an old Nintendo game, Tetris, that learned to pause the game before the last brick fell so that it would never lose. That's very clever. I love it. But, you know, when you're talking about something that has a weapon on it, you may be less comfortable with some of these surprising behaviors that we see out of machine learning. Surprise is probably not what you want in that setting. And so militaries are going to use this technology. They're a couple years behind the commercial sector. There's a little bit of a time lag, but they are catching up. They're working on it. But I think there's an important educational component and a reliability and resiliency component that comes into play when thinking about these machine learning tools in these really safety critical applications.
Okay, so that's the technology part of it. And your book is, like I said, well detailed, well researched, you're well respected. Is this all living within the Pentagon, or is this going to gravitate to Capitol Hill, and will you be to testify?
There is a lot of interest on Capitol Hill. There is actually an amendment on the books right now being debated up on the Hill as part of the Defense Authorization Act for this year that involves autonomous weapons and asking the Pentagon to do some more reporting back to Congress on what their strategies are and how they're thinking about this. So there's growing interest in Congress, which I think is great. You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that this is not just an issue for military professionals and defense companies. I think this is an issue that affects all of us. I think it's wonderful that there has been a lot of engagement from members of civil society, human rights groups, scientists and engineers and AI researchers. And I'd like to see more of that. It's an issue that touches on a variety of disciplines: engineering, law, ethics, policy, strategy. And I think, you know, to be able to grapple with this technology in a way that understands some of these competitive dynamics, but also moves forward in a way that is lawful, that's ethical, that's safe, is going to require a cross-disciplinary dialogue with a whole variety of communities.
Okay, there's one lily pad I want to land on to end, and you mentioned it in that answer, and that was strategy. Could you define for us, please, strategic stability as a term, as a policy term, and then we'll get into the state of strategic stability and what facets you're looking at?
Sure. So strategic stability is a term that came out early in the days of the Cold War, looking at the nuclear balance of power. And the concern was initially, actually, among nuclear strategists, that the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe was in a vulnerable state, and that a first strike by the Soviet Union could wipe out the U.S. nuclear arsenal in Europe. And the concern was that the possibility of this might incentivize the Soviets to strike first. And in fact, knowing this, the U.S. might have to launch their weapons first. And it creates kind of this gunslinger dynamic, this idea that we need to launch first to prevent him from launching first against us. This concept of instability, or a fragile stability, is one that really troubled nuclear strategists throughout the Cold War. And they took a lot of measures to try to create a more stable environment, one that would be more resilient against perturbations or friction in the international environment. So one of the concerns about autonomy and autonomous weapons is that this degree of automation might lead to automatic responses and retaliations. And we've seen this in other settings, other competitive environments. There was a famous case a couple of years ago where some bots on Amazon that were doing book pricing escalated the price of a textbook to some, you know, an insane amount. We've seen this certainly in stock trading, where there's been an arms race in speed in high frequency trading. And we have had instances like flash crashes where you have these unexpected interactions between algorithms. And so we don't want something like that in warfare. We don't want to see a flash war. That would be catastrophic. And so one of the concerns that I get into in the book is, how do you mitigate against these risks? In stock trading, we have seen developments like circuit breakers that take the stock offline if the price moves too quickly. Well, we don't have a referee in war to call timeout. There's no one, there's no regulator, there's no one to say stop. And militaries are not going to share their algorithms with their adversaries any more than a stock trading company would do so.
Right.
So one of the things that strategists worry about is, how do we create an environment where we avoid some of these unexpected consequences with automation?
The book is called Army of None. It's 300 well-researched pages. It's not impenetrable, which is why I could read it and still follow along with it. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That's Paul Shari. He's a Pentagon defense expert and former U.S. Army Ranger, and his new book is titled Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. For links to his book or his bio, or for any of the sourcing we use on the show, period, please go to KGORadio.com and look for this week's show notes article. We also post at Facebook.com/TechonomicsRadio, and I'm on Twitter. I'm at KGOJason. That's it for this week. We thank our guests, as always, for sharing their expertise. For producer Liana Wilcox, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics. Have great weeks, everybody.